I've been thinking about this a lot, about freedom from versus freedom to. So the little connector word after freedom really matters a lot, doesn't it? Like, you want freedom to be able to live without fear, for example, freedom to be able to love who you want. But you also want freedom from poverty. You want freedom from, you know, the type of oppression, or freedom from the lack of freedoms that we feel right now.
Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, the podcast about how we win against authoritarianism and become the founders of a free country. This season, our conversations run along three streams. The first stream is arts and culture. We feature arts and culture because culture flows upstream of politics, prefiguring the possible and showing people what freedom feels like. The second stream is elections. Holding the line around free and fair elections is critical to protecting our freedoms. And the third is the world beyond our borders. We focus there because authoritarianism is a global project and the resistance has to be too. What connects all three is a conviction that we can win if we act strategically, build across our differences, and use the tools of nonviolent civil resistance that have turned back authoritarian movements before. Let's get into it. I want to start with an image. Think about how a river forms. It doesn't come from one source. It doesn't start as a river. It starts as hundreds of springs, each one bubbling up from the earth in its own place, in its own way, with its own character. Each spring has its own temperature, its own rhythm, its own mineral content. And each one is distinct. Each one is alive in its own right. Springs don't merge. They flow. They find each other. They become tributaries, and tributaries moving in the same direction become a river. And the river is powerful in a way that no spring could ever be, not because the springs have given up what makes them distinct, but because they are all moving toward the same water. This is the image I keep returning to when I think about what this moment in American democracy actually requires of us. We don't need a single movement with a single ideology and a single voice. We've tried that, and the traffic jam of competing frameworks has left us gridlocked, easy to divide, and slow to act when the moments that matter arrive. What we need is springs, deep-rooted, trust-based communities of practice where people know each other, have worked together, and have earned each other's trust through actual shared risk and shared purpose. Places where people are held and known and strengthened, where the analysis gets sharpened and the commitment gets renewed. And we need someone who knows how to help those springs find each other, who can trace the contours of the terrain, identify the tributaries that are already flowing, and help move them in the same direction without asking any of them to stop being what they are. And that is, I think, exactly what network weavers do. And that's why I'm so glad to be in conversation today with someone who has spent her career doing exactly that work, building the connective tissue that turns dispersed, community-rooted energy into something that moves together, that holds under pressure, that becomes more powerful rather than less when the obstacles are greatest. That person is Julia Roig, the founder and chief network weaver of the Horizons Project, with over 30 years of experience in democratic change and conflict transformation. She spent 14 years as president and CEO of Partners Global before launching the Horizons Project in 2022 to focus on peace building, social justice, and democracy in the U.S. As the architect of groundbreaking research on narratives for peace, she collaborates with philanthropists, nonprofits, and movement builders to integrate narrative competency into social change efforts. With fieldwork in over 50 countries, she previously served as country director for the American Bar Association Rule of Law Initiative in Serbia and spent 5 years in Colombia specializing in community justice. Julia also holds trustee roles with the Othering and Belonging Institute and the Alliance for Peacebuilding. Julia, welcome and thank you for your work and for joining me today.
Thanks, Scott. What a wonderful introduction. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, you're well deserving of one. I want to start with a question I'm asking everyone these days. What does freedom mean to you? And what does it mean to live in a free country?
It's interesting because, you know, freedom is a word that we've been extolled to use more and more now, that somehow it's a framing for U.S. democracy building that could help us find each other across many lines of difference. And I've been thinking about this a lot, about freedom from versus freedom to. So the little connector word after freedom really matters a lot, doesn't it? Like your freedom, you want freedom to be able to live without fear. For example, freedom to be able to love who you want. But you also want freedom from poverty. You want freedom from, you know, the type of oppression, or freedom from, you know, all of the lack of freedoms that we feel right now. And so I think it goes to the rights and responsibilities of a just and free society, that you have to kind of extend that freedom and then also be willing to work for it. So that's not like children playing freely in a park kind of answer. It's more of like a political science kind of answer. But I think it's going to be a theme of our conversation, that it's nuanced. And so for me, I just probably see a lot of nuance in the question.
Okay. Well, that was helpful. So, you know, we at the 22nd Century Initiative have been developing the idea that movements powerful enough to defeat authoritarianism are not built from a single source. They are the convergence, as I said earlier, of many streams, each drawing from its own leadership, ideological frameworks, and energy. In that framework, organizations play a vital role building and maintaining the infrastructure we need to communicate across springs and to activate the river. Now, you, as someone who thinks a lot about and practices building that kind of infrastructure, can you share what you've been seeing that's been working?
Yeah, I would probably say what's been working more than anything, let's say in the last year and a half or 2 years, is I think that there's a lot of motivation to work in this way now. I think there's a recognition of needing to break down silos, so that you know, perhaps even the rhetoric of a broader movement has become mainstreamed in our field. And I think that is a huge achievement, because that hasn't always been the case, as we've been talking about the need to organize across difference. So I'm particularly motivated and also really inspired by the ways that people are seeking connective tissue more than they have in the past.
Well, I've been seeing that too. It feels like people are starting to wake up and see the need to be able to work together across differences, right? But without necessarily flattening those differences out. One of those efforts that I see is the big tent organizing that you've been leading. Can you tell me more about it? What's the theory of change and what's been working there?
Yeah, well, not to get too jargony on you, but I really believe in systems level organizing. And you and I have talked about this a lot, but I do feel like when you know, it's this idea of coming together across difference to work on a common goal, this is nothing new. People have done this around coalitional work, different issue area advocacy, that we find each other across difference. But the reason that big tent organizing in this moment is different is because we have consolidation of an authoritarian regime at the national level, which requires of us to have, I mean, the United States is such a huge country. It's so diverse. So many different systems and people are affected by the policies of the government. Then therefore, the way that we organize needs to take that complexity into account. And so, you know, for us, big tent and the way that we think about the system that we're trying to impact, you can't get the whole system in a room together. You have to get a slice of the system in the room together. So the slice of the system for us is based on pillars of support, as you know, or sectoral actors. So when we were scoping who we should be organizing with under this big tent, it was based on a framework or an approach of thinking about power building across sectors, where power flows from the bottom up to a system of governance. So businesses, veterans, faith groups. arts and cultural workers, labor unions, civic organizations, professional associations. It's those civic identities and the power that they wield within the very diverse nature of each of those different sectors that when they come together to mobilize and also sense make and build relationships across those sectors, that's when we think that we're building the right kind of power to meet this moment within this complex system of the United States. Uh-huh. So Big Tent is a group of sector network leaders.
Okay. Well, can you help us understand the difference between a big tent and a coalition? Because it doesn't seem to me that you're trying to build a traditional coalition like you would build for a campaign. Rather, it seems like some of the operative questions here are guided by pillars of support analysis and, you know, trying to reach sustained participation at critical mass. So what's the difference?
Yeah, sometimes I think that when you come into a coalitional space, you are expecting to find alignment around common goals, eventually having to make decisions on tactics, timeframes, targets, maybe sometimes even a time-bound goal that you set for yourselves, like a particular policy that you're trying to pass or stop. And I think that what's been different about Big Tent organizing is you don't start from the place of seeking alignment. So you start from a framework of wanting everyone to understand the benefit of organizing across pillars. Mm-hmm. You want to share an understanding of the authoritarian threat. So to a certain extent, it's a posture of what you're against as a starting point. And then Big Tent organizing, at least for the Horizons Project, is really grounded in relational infrastructure and relationship building and starting from where people are. So, if you've got a group of veterans, what are they the most interested in? What are they prioritizing the most? What do their constituencies care about? And you don't come in to say, well, I think we should all now talk about the elections. Or I think we should all be talking about ICE raids. But you really have to ask them, what do they care about? And then organically find kind of the constellations within Big Tent to kind of build the collaborative muscle based on what is organically of interest to the group, to then, of course, eventually build up the collective muscle to be doing something a little bit more jointly, right? That the entire formation can think about what they want to do together. But I think that's very different from a coalition that probably has to kind of come up with their priorities, figure out the strategies of meeting the priorities. It's a little bit more defined and, dare I say, transactional, which is okay too. Sometimes it's okay to be in a transactional relationship with others to accomplish something. But Big Tent, to propel us forward and to really practice the pluralism that we want to see in the future, the way that we organize the space has to look and feel different.
Uh-huh. What are some of the key tensions that you're seeing in that work, though?
Yeah, I mean, clearly some of the tensions are that certain participants or members within the Big Tent are experiencing the harms of the authoritarian threats or resurgence much more squarely and urgently in the right now. So if we have immigrant rights groups within the Big Tent who really need to feel solidarity with their communities right now, and you have others who are maybe organizing across conservative communities, trying to kind of invite people into kind of team democracy, conservative spaces, that they feel that the immigration issue would not be the right issue to lead on, then there are tensions with regards to what different groups are able to step into and how that can feel potentially like I'm not experiencing the solidarity that I need from this space. And so then we quickly need to realize, actually, that this isn't the space for that kind of solidarity. So we don't want to leave like our issue or our identity-based organizing to be able to participate in Big Tent. But we do need to have like a higher order understanding of the democracy goals that we're trying to achieve together. And then the tensions of semantics. Quite honestly, like, we have a hard time with listening for curiosity. If someone expresses themselves in a certain way that can be quote unquote triggering to someone else in the group, that, you know, that happens all the time. And but this happens in every, you know, it can happen in family dynamics as well. So that's just being human together, I think. Mm-hmm. But when you get so many different mindsets and priorities and constituencies and organizing contexts in the same room, you really have to practice being open-minded and open with each other and not, you know, harden in your own way of being and doing. Easier said than done.
It's not exactly how we're socialized to behave generally in the United States. So it's a challenge, isn't it? So I want to take us around the world now. You've spent, as I said earlier, 30 years working for democratic change in over 30 countries. So from your experience working around the world in Latin America and Eastern Europe, what have you learned about how authoritarianism takes hold?
Well, unfortunately, it takes hold slowly. That is the new reality. When we've studied some repressive movements in the past, you know, there's been coups, there's been violent takeovers. So you know when you're in one system or the other. But the slow drip of democratic erosion is a challenge to wake up from. You know, the horrible metaphor of the boiling frogs is real, I think. And so I have really benefited from living and working in countries that have either, you know, been in acute conflict. So you know what it feels like when the whole system breaks down and you start killing each other. So you know why, you know, democratic stability is so important to fight for, to stand up for, to be courageous. And I guess that would be the other thing that I've learned from all of the colleagues around the world, how courageous they were, and that courage looks different in different contexts. Sometimes courage doesn't look like being the loudest, most public, defiant person on the street with a sign. It's the one who actually can navigate within the system to build those alliances across difference, kind of the quiet, unseen work that's needed within a context that is potentially very repressive to keep going. Actually, there's a tenacity and a persistence that you learn from other parts of the world. So it makes me very humble in the work that we do now, because I've also just experienced some, you know, much more difficult environments than we are confronting, even though it's hard. And, you know, of course, I'm saying that from a place of privilege, perhaps here outside of Washington, D.C., but man, can it get worse. And it has in a lot of different societies.
Yeah, it definitely has. Here in the United States, I feel like it happened in stages. You know, we consider the war on drugs, for example, which basically built the carceral and surveillance infrastructure that this administration now in power can use. And along with things like, you know, civil asset forfeiture, which was justified in the war on drugs, which can be deployed against us now. And so all these little steps along the way seem to be, you know, really the way in which we end up in this soup, right? Because certain red lines for certain groups of people don't get touched when they don't see what the end goal is. So very clarifying to understand it that way, I think.
Well, you know, Scott, can I say that kind of brings us back to your first question about freedom? And what I have seen, that exact example of drug policy in the carceral state, is that we have been really challenged by issues and narratives, dare I say, of security and what security and freedom means, like freedom to walk down the street and somehow feel, you know, there's just these narratives of security. And I have seen that play out in so many parts of the world, that somehow governments start stripping away rights and freedoms in the name of security. And that then people don't realize the rights that they're giving up and or giving up those rights in the name of somehow, you know, a whole group of people having to suffer injustices. And we see that more and more now, right? How the securitization message is really being used.
All right. I don't want to embarrass you by behaving like a fanboy, but I've learned so much from you and more every time we talk. One of the things that I learned from you, though, is the word, and that word is intermestic. Can you tell our listeners what intermestic means and where it fits within the work that's ahead of us?
Yeah, and I do think that we cannot take credit for that word. I can't remember who came up with it originally, but for those of us who have worked internationally and who are now also working domestically, it's a way of us describing international and domestic. So we say intermestic. And the concept is that, first of all, if we're fighting for democracy right now, if we're really in the fight against authoritarianism, this is a human condition. It is not only happening to the United States right now. And there are obviously historic lessons to learn, but there are very modern day elements to this challenge. And so if it is a human challenge, we need to be in it together with our international colleagues. And whether it's Brazil, whether it's India, you know, obviously, right now we're celebrating in April the win, the democratic win in Hungary. But, you know, I think it's especially important for international solidarity networks working for democracy. We see kind of these regressive policies around gender issues and other rights. And so the intermestic nature of our work is to remind ourselves that, first of all, we're in it together. And second of all, we have a lot to learn and to build upon from our colleagues working in other conditions overseas.
All right. Well, that was really clarifying to me the first time I had it defined, because I saw the word and I thought, what's that? So it's actually helpful to know, and helpful to know how it works. So now, weaving together, you know, these kinds of connections into powerful networks seems to be kind of an art for you. Whether you're bringing people together across borders, sectors, or fields, there seems to be a kind of a craft at work. So how do you approach network weaving, and why is it an important part of the strategy right now?
Well, it's interesting that we just talked about Big Tent, and we talked about our role as Horizons, as convening, as the facilitative stakeholder. But I do think that there's an element of network weaving that isn't necessarily being the central convener of a space or of a formation. A lot of weaving work is, as you know, our colleague John Paul Lederach talks a lot about the weaving work of spiders. Like, it's literally an insect metaphor of closely participating with certain networks or certain groups, hearing where their energy is, what they're excited about, what they care about, where they actually may have some blind spots that you could help to kind of plant the seed, because you have the benefit of also having been in other different groups. And so, you know, the weaving work is actually like a spider going from one group to another group to another group to another group. And the web is actually weaving behind you. So that, I think sometimes we might think weaving means that you're trying to kind of bring everyone together to weave them, to kind of know each other, et cetera. And I think you're weaving people, but you're also weaving ideas. You're weaving resources. And some of it is really just the process of showing up for other people. And then, you know, sometimes you're being provocative by asking questions. Sometimes you're being really helpful by making the connections. But it's an unsung job, I think, of just continually thinking about how the system actually could be strengthened when there's kind of a curation function, I guess I would say, of the need for, like, well, who needs to know whom when, and or what resources would be useful in which contexts. And that's a part of weaving work as well.
Well, you said the work is unsung. So what do network weavers need that we may not have fully recognized?
Yeah, there's a spaciousness that I think is needed to hold a lot of that diversity in your head and in your heart. And so some of the work is really just the solidarity with others. Like when some parts of the work is particularly hard, I think one of the most important ways to support network weavers is just with continual sense making. Like this, the process of actually talking to colleagues to say, well, this is what I'm hearing over here, and this is what I'm hearing over here, and this seems to be a gap, but I don't even know how to make sense about what's going on over here. So, you know, the time that it takes to slow down to then reflect on what you're observing and hearing and noticing will then allow for the weaving work to be, you know, more impactful. And I think that when you're trying to be in too many spaces with too many people, there's like way too much to weave. It, you know, when it comes right down to it, then you do have to make time actually for that discernment and sense making. That, I mean, I'm saying this because I need to hear it probably.
Well, and how do you define success in the weaving work you do?
Yeah, I wonder, how do you find success? Hopefully it's when others are receiving some kind of benefit from the connections or the weaving insights that you're bringing. I mean, my particular success is also when folks that perhaps didn't know each other before and are, you know, in partnership or collaboration now. So you see the fruits of those connections turning into something kind of more concrete that wouldn't have existed if you hadn't brought people together. But another success for me, honestly, is potentially like just through the example that you live, demonstrating to others how important the weaving work is. Not everybody's going to do that work. Not everybody's going to see themselves as needing to kind of, you know, everybody has a lane perhaps that they've chosen that they want to dig down and deeper into. But another way of thinking about weaving is the systems level organizing. And so I also want to kind of demonstrate to people the importance of the slowing down, of building relationships, of thinking about how they fit within the ecosystem. So part of the success is that others also would really value that as a role and potentially want to kind of shift their own mindsets and behaviors accordingly.
I want to switch gears a little bit, or at least shift our attention to a particular part of the tent that you've been building, the big tent that you've been building. Let's talk about the role of artists and cultural workers in this time. What have you been learning from organizing with artists and cultural workers?
Yeah, well, this is a, you know, this is a love that we both share, isn't it, Scott? And something that we're both committed to. I mean, the reason that I am as committed to organizing both arts and cultural workers together as what we call like a tent pole, a whole kind of space in and of itself, but then also weaving that into like incorporating those talents and perspectives and voices into the big tent is partially because I think that they are conscientiously thinking about touching people not only in the headspace, but also the heart space. And if part of the crisis that we're facing under the authoritarian regime is a meaning-making crisis, we're really questioning what is happening right now. Who are we in this context? I think artists and cultural workers have a way of making meaning or helping us to make meaning, whether it's through metaphor, whether it's through, you know, the symbolism of art, whether it's how you feel because of song and music or dance, then we really need help with meaning making right now. And then, of course, you know, we have to choose tactics right now. We have to choose how to make political violence backfire. We need to think about like really resonant, like non-cooperation tactics. And so I think artist activists have really different ways of thinking about what those community interventions could be and look like. So really, it's the power not just only of just letting artists go and do their thing, but the strategic magic that happens when you get kind of, you know, tacticians within the movement space together with artists who might think about, well, how do we capture the imagination right now of ICE's overreach, of the cruelty of this administration? Is it just the kind of mutual aid networks and all of the things that we know are needed for the community? But how do we help make people make sense of why this is as cruel as it is? And so I do think that it's the magic of the ways of thinking about our activism that also is really important.
Mm. And also communicating in a variety of different ways that touch people differently and create the sense of a community that you belong to, that you step into when you join the civil resistance movement. Yeah, I always think of arts and artists as part of the democratic infrastructure we need in order to have a truly equitable democracy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the lessons from pro-democracy history that has inspired both of us is the Chilean No campaign, which basically illuminates how joy can drive resistance. So can you talk about that campaign and what we can learn from it and why and how joy, and I mean seriously, joy can be a serious strategic choice?
Yeah, and you know, I really recommend that anyone who has not watched the movie No about the No campaign should watch it, because there is a scene in that movie that just is emblazoned in my brain. And it's the first time that it occurred to, you know, the coalition or the, you know, essentially the United Front that was organizing against Pinochet thought to bring in an advertising agency into this work. And they had a first brainstorm, and all of the activists really wanted to make sure to highlight the human rights abuses. They really wanted the disappeared to be elevated. The injustices, the harm, and the advertising agency said, that does not sell. People are going to look away from that. And as we're calling people into this future, you need me to help you call people into this bright future. And the tension in that room at that moment, it was, you know, a really dramatic moment in the movie. So the thing about the No campaign that I really insist upon is how hard it was for the United Front that was organizing against Pinochet to land on that framing. Because we look at it now as this big success. Oh, look, they had a rainbow. They were talking about the future of Chile. All of the advertising was, you know, dancing and different, you know, diverse faces of Chile and people. And it worked. But we don't see behind the scenes how hard it was for a diverse coalition of folks who had lived through such harms to be able to say, I'm not giving that up. And of course, we know there was a whole reconciliation process afterwards. So then therefore, we also have to think strategically about the strategic nature of joy and a yes coalition that we're building, which doesn't mean that we're not going to give up on truth and accountability and justice seeking in the future. And Chile did just that. But so anyway, I look at that campaign and I recognize the trade-offs and the tensions that we make when we get to joy as one of the ways that we call the most people in to the future that we're going to share as a country.
It reminds me of what the Thai democracy movement has done. You know, I mean, they're making great gains there. And when you see the political ads that they put up, they're not, you know, hit ads. They're not, you know, attacks on the authoritarians. They're joyful celebrations of cultural diversity. Mm-hmm. And it just basically reminds people, this is what freedom feels like. You know, this is what it could be, you know. That's and right. Yeah, what a powerful impact they're having. So, you know, what we've been talking about is a set of major cultural shifts, right? Shifts in our movement culture to reconceive how we engage power, and shifts in our overall culture to renew and reconstruct democratic values and practices. Those kinds of changes require pretty serious narrative strategy chops, which I know you have too. So help us out here. Can you talk about narrative competencies and how they fit into your organizing approach?
Yeah, when we say narrative competencies, some people think about that as a way of crafting good stories, crafting good messages, you know, somehow that we're going to kind of package a message in a creative way that's going to be sticky for people. And I think about narrative competencies very differently. I think about, if you think of narrative as again, a meaning-making system, that we actually are telling stories to ourselves about how the world works, and we filter information through that lens in our own minds, then we really can't make meaning for other people. So a narrative competency is actually reminding ourselves that I will not change your mind through a well-crafted messaging campaign. I may animate my base and the people who are making meaning the same way that I am. But if we really want to help people shift in a way of being and doing or thinking, then one narrative competency is allowing for the complexity of different meaning-making systems. So a rich narrative landscape actually is not one simple story. It's a lot of different ways of being and seeing in the world. That is actually a competency in and of itself. The other competency, though, that I think about a lot that I still don't think that we have is, how do we know when our strategies of communicating in the world or the stories that we're telling perhaps are having its own backfire? When are we driving people away? And how are we even conscious of, are we taking the time to actually observe when we're making things worse? whether it's the divisiveness, whether it's feeding into individualism and, you know, this meta narratives of either, you know, scarcity models versus abundance. I think that there's a way of really deeply thinking about the impact that we're having, not just in our communications campaigns, but, you know, everything that we represent when we're in front of a group, we're giving a speech, we're writing a report, we're labeling, you know, our campaign. All of these things, I think we have to have a competency about how are we conscientiously making the decision between short-term gains and long-term goals that we may have. And I think sometimes those are in tension. And that's a competency in and of itself to even recognize that I'm making a choice.
Okay. Well, if you were speaking directly to a new organizer, trainer, artist, you know, who feels overwhelmed and wonders if their work matters, what would you say to them? What's one thing you wish more people in this movement understood about how change really happens?
Yeah. I mean, do we know how change really happens? I mean, it's part of the answer is just to do something. First of all, you know, so that everybody feels that they can make a difference in their community and that they're observing who else might care as well, so that they're, you know, doing their best to link up with others and not going it alone. We have a lot of folks who have kind of hero complexes in our movements. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's not necessarily helpful to think that, you know, we all have to solve all the problems of the world. So I don't know. I do feel like sometimes we can simplify it by saying, you know, pick something that you really care about, work hard in it, but then bring other people along and, you know, don't go it alone, and then take care of yourself and be joyful, like you were just saying, and that it's okay to take time off and to also be silly sometimes. Because I observe a lot of overly seriousness. In hard times, I think that is an act of resistance in and of itself.
Beautiful. So what action should people be taking right now?
Making sure they're registered to vote. It's very literal. You know, not being quiet, standing up and being courageous, getting offline to a certain extent. You know, I do think there's a bit of touch grass as a saying, like just get off your phone and get outside and touch grass, is is really, really needed. I think there's I believe in digital organizing. I think it is a terrain that we need to be paying attention to. And sometimes we overemphasize that, and we really just need to be connecting with people in real life. Go touch grass.
Well, you know, I've been seeing celebrations all over Hungary over the ouster of Orban. And, you know, this is April, folks, so that, you know, this, it all happened just a week ago as we're taping. And it's way too early to be making this out as a full victory. So how do we account for the 16 years of organizing in Hungary? How do we address the fact that the candidate is a defector from the authoritarian regime? It just seems like we're so far away from this kind of moment in the U.S. When will it occur to us to organize in a different way and grapple with the things that are hard? I mean, those are all the things that seem to come up. So what do you think?
Yeah, I appreciate that you're naming the distinctions, because I have observed the reaction in the U.S., we are so thrilled. And, you know, obviously in solidarity with our Hungarian colleagues, because they are so thrilled. So yes, the happiness is real. And yet to say that illiberalism, you know, is on its back foot and somehow, you know, the international network that, you know, was had its sun and moon with Orban, I think is a little bit of an overreach of the where we are. So because, like you just named, it's been 16 years. And I think that there's an element of having really reached, I don't want to say rock bottom, but it's been bad in Hungary. Really, really bad. Every facet of society has been touched by that authoritarian government. And we can't say that in the US yet. There are still people who don't want to recognize or don't recognize the level of harm. They still think our institutions hold. They still think that, you know, our the elections, the judiciary, and there's cases obviously where, you know, we are seeing those successes, but it's not going to erase the entrenched authoritarian faction that's here, just in the way that the authoritarian faction hasn't left Hungary either. So it's too soon to say, like, okay, you know, victory is won. So an electoral win is a huge accomplishment. Almost 80% of the population came out to vote. Can you imagine the results of our elections if 80% of eligible voters voted, Scott? Like, really, we know that we do not have the government that the majority of us want. And I think that that level of participation arrived because the pain in the country was as fierce as it was. And indeed, because of the level of organizing, the backfire around, you know, some of the, our friend Daniel Hunter just wrote this wonderful article about the lessons to be learned. And, you know, when Orban tried to cancel Pride last year, and you know, it was one of the biggest Pride celebrations they've had, you know, in decades, that was an act of both mass defiance, but also making his overreach backfire. And I think that we've got to pick some really key moments where more people in the United States context are going to be inspired to get off the couch and get involved and see the executive overreach for what it is. We think that that might be happening right now with a feud with the Pope, you know, with all of the kind of fissures that we're seeing within the religious part of the MAGA faction. But I don't know, Scott. I think we've got our own 16-year trajectory. So, you know, the main lesson to learn from Hungary is how long they kept at it, because we're going to have to keep at it for just as long, if not longer.
Yes. Well, that's why we need joy, isn't it? Because we're going to be in this for the long haul. Thank you so much for spending the time with us, Julia.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. This was a fun conversation. Appreciate you very much.
Well, I appreciate you too. Always fun to talk to you. One thing Julia said that I keep thinking about: networks are resilient because there's no single point of failure to attack. But they require deep trust in the kinds of ties between clusters that let innovation spread without central control. That doesn't happen at the national level, but where you are. Find your cluster, build those ties, get connected to the organizing in your community that's already in motion, and help those springs find each other. And for the strategic framework behind everything Julia and I discussed today, the pillars analysis, the network theory, the comparative research that defeats authoritarianism, it's all at the Anti-Authoritarian Playbook on Substack at bit.ly/anti-authoritarian playbook. Thanks for listening to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast. If this conversation was useful to you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. That's how this movement grows. The river doesn't form from one source. It starts where you are. We'll see you next time.